news when you want it. Get the latest headlines with the Bloomberg News Now podcast.
The latest developments in the war in the Middle East.
Inflation relief for consumers.
The top headlines from Bloomberg News, updated continuously throughout the day.
All in less than 5 minutes.
The House and Senate passing that spending bill.
Tesla's support among Wall Street bulls is weakening.
Get the latest news when you want it at the click of a button.
Now to the latest on the race for president.
Listen on Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Business App.
And anywhere you get your podcasts. Bloomberg News Now. Context changes everything.
A major shift in politics in Canada, but not necessarily due to anything that's changed up there.
Actually, something south of the border changed. You elected a president who has had a lot of impact in our politics in Canada.
I'm Marco Werman. A snap election called in Canada. We look at that. And domestic politics in Israel, could the next few days be a turning point?
This is probably the most critical week in the history of Israel's democracy.
Plus, harvesting coffee in Costa Rica. They're exporting less coffee because not enough migrant workers are showing up to pick beans. And the backstories to some of the intriguing dish names on a Chinese menu.
The joke is even a Buddha would jump over the wall to eat it. That would just show how delicious this dish is.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Co-host Carolyn Beeler is away this week. Thank you for joining us this Monday. We begin the show today in Turkey, where the mayor of Istanbul has been chosen by the main opposition party as its nominee for president. But here is the catch. Ekrem İmamoğlu is currently under arrest, accused by Turkey's government of leading a conspiracy at City Hall to accept bribes and embezzle money. Before he was detained, İmamoğlu was emerging as a prominent rival of Turkey's current and long-serving president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The mayor's supporters say the charges against him amount to a political coup. The World's Duri Biskaran reports.
Outside a branch of the Republican People's Party, or CHP, people of all ages stand in a long line. Why did I come? I came for democracy, for Turkey, for myself and for my future, says Gözde Kosemen, an interior designer in Istanbul.
Hayır diyebilme sesimin olduğu için.
Being able to say no to those in power, and because I have a voice. Although Kosemen voted in the CHP primary for imprisoned candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu, she's not a member of the party. Neither is anyone in this line, which continues upstairs to the party branch office on the third floor of a small shopping mall. Presidential nominees in Turkey are almost always appointed by their party, not elected in a primary. But for the first time, the CHP had planned one for Sunday, hoping to demonstrate Istanbul's mayor has broad appeal across the country. After İmamoğlu was jailed last week, the CHP decided to open up voting for everyone, putting out 5,000 solidarity voting boxes across the country for non-party members. Over the course of the day, 13 million people cast symbolic votes for İmamoğlu, alongside some 2 million CHP members. Volunteer Bilge Kundar says the high turnout for İmamoğlu shows the lack of confidence voters have in the current government from all sides of the political spectrum. We want to express here that the electorate no longer wants the people in power and that there must be a change, Kundar says. Last night, İmamoğlu's party called supporters to Saraçhane, a tree-lined park just across the street from the mayor's office at City Hall.
Mayor İmamoğlu's first instruction after he was detained was that the municipal services should not be interrupted because of this.
When I reached İmamoğlu's diplomatic advisor, Mustafa Osman Turan, he sounded tired.
Never before. Not even during military coups that we had in the past, has a leading presidential nominee been taken from his bed and imprisoned.
Inside the Saraçhane municipal offices, CHP officials have been taking shifts to stay in the building, Turan says, out of concern that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's central government will appoint a loyalist trustee to oversee Istanbul. In a statement, Erdogan's communications office said İmamoğlu's arrest was not politically motivated.
I mean, it's sad that we have to go through this, but on the other hand, I think this is a political struggle that was needed to be made. to really, you know, pull our country out of this darkness.
Shebnem Gumushchu, a Middlebury College professor who specializes in democratic backsliding, says that after a decade of Erdogan centralizing the government around his party, the protests show that there is still a vibrant opposition.
They still are resilient. They're still showing up. They're still fighting for their rights. And they understand what's at stake.
High voter turnout on Sunday, particularly in districts that have traditionally gone for Erdogan, show this too.
People are not just supporting İmamoğlu as a future candidate, but they're also supporting their right to choose who's going to be leading the next government.
In speeches, Erdogan has accused İmamoğlu's party of polarizing the country, attacking police, and intimidating the judiciary by calling for these protests. While tens of thousands of people were permitted to peacefully demonstrate outside of Sarıçhane last night, others clashed with police and were pushed back with tear gas and plastic bullets. Videos like this one show security forces tackling protesters to the ground and kicking them as they try to escape. While more than 70 people were taken into custody at the protest, others were arrested later, from their homes at 6 a.m., including 10 journalists today. Although İmamoğlu is now officially his party's presidential candidate for 2028, he cannot run if he's convicted of a crime. He'll spend the next months or years in prison as the trial continues. For The World, I'm Derya Buzgarin, Istanbul.
Canada's new prime minister called for new elections this weekend. Here's how Mark Carney explained to Canadian voters what's at stake.
We are facing the most significant crisis of our lifetimes because of President Trump's unjustified trade actions and his threats to our sovereignty.
Carney was speaking on Sunday, standing at a podium with the words Canada First across the front of it. Carney's rival in the upcoming election will be Pierre Poilievre, who had a similar message for voters around the issue of Canadian sovereignty.
I will strengthen our country so that we can be capable of standing our own 2 feet and standing up to the Americans where and when necessary.
Earlier today, I spoke with Kevin Quigley, a public policy scholar at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and asked him what prompted Mark Carney's call for snap elections.
In our tradition, the parliamentary tradition, it's the prime minister's job to go to the governor general, who is the monarch's representative, and ask the monarch's representative to dissolve parliament and call an election. So the prime minister has that advantage. And right now, Mark Carney represents the Liberal Party. It's been doing very, very well in the last month or so. They've had a surge in the polls. So he thinks this is a good opportunity to have the election now.
Well, you mentioned the Liberal Party had this surge recently. The party was not looking good, though, just a few months ago. What changed?
So actually, something south of the border changed. You elected a president who has had a lot of impact in our politics in Canada. I think it's had a very significant impact, of course, because we have a high degree of interdependence and integration of the American economy. And with Mr. Trump talking about tariffs, that's really sent sort of shockwaves through the economic and political spheres in Canada. And there's a lot of anxiety and stress about what the impact will be on the Canadian economy.
So we'll get to his top challenger in a moment. But who is Mark Carney as a politician? We've heard a lot about his technocratic bona fides.
Yeah, so as a politician, it's really hard to say at this point. We don't really know. He's quite a newcomer in the political scene, but not so much of a newcomer in terms of his very, very distinguished career as an economist. He's led the Bank of England and the Bank of Canada through tough times, so he's not unfamiliar with crises. But he's never actually run for office. So he's kind of been always on the periphery of Canadian politics and kind of flirting a little bit with the Liberal Party. And when Mr. Trudeau stepped down, Mark Carney threw his name in the hat and very quickly became the leader of the Liberal Party. So he's actually not been tested. Interesting, he's never actually held an elected office. And I think one of the big questions in the campaign is going to be, how well does Mark Carney campaign?
Right. So Mark Carney's top challenger is the leader of the Conservative Party, Pierre Poilievre. What are the biggest differences between him and Carney when it comes to foreign policy?
Pierre Poilievre, up until now, really has owned issues around affordability, keeping taxes low. He's a career politician. He first ran for office and was elected when he was 25 years old. So he really hasn't, in a way, worked outside of the House of Commons, right? This has been his job. I mean, not House of Commons, but elected politics. And I think one of the groups he'll be looking at in particular are kind of blue-collar workers to say, I've got your back. I'll be helping you during this tough time with the tariffs. But it's really framed around more efficiency, downsizing government, and cutting taxes, and of course, standing up for Canada.
To what degree has the saber rattling in Washington prompted a surge in nationalism in Canada, and how rare is that? And could it play into the campaigns and fortunes of either of these two candidates?
I do think there's still some important questions about the election that haven't quite formed yet, about who's best positioned to defend Canadian interests. What is the way forward? Is it about more efficient government? Is it about better taxes? Is it about interprovincial trade? Is it about European trading partnerships? Is it about being tougher on Donald Trump? And who's best to do that? And then finally, who's going to have the most effective campaign? Who can connect with people? I mean, one of the things that I think people look for is sort of trustworthiness with their politicians. And that means technical expertise, certainly, but it's also about being open with people. And it's about being concerned. And I think that concern piece, that empathy piece, is going to be really important when people, you know, turn on the television or listen to their podcasts or whatever, who's really connecting with them and saying, I've got your back, and then people are going to vote on that message. And I don't think that's quite clear yet. We've certainly seen a big bump in the Liberal Party, but when I think about the 84 John Turner and 1993 Kim Campbell elections, those were leaders that went in up in the polls and then had bad campaigns, and then they were demolished when they actually came to election day. So we don't really know yet. It's still early days.
Kevin Quigley is a professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. In space news, the rings of Saturn seem to disappear over the weekend. It's a rare cosmic illusion that will put the rings out of sight from Earth's point of view for a few more days. We asked Larry Esposito to explain why. He's a professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder.
The rings appear to be disappearing, and that's because Saturn, as it orbits the Sun, it's tilted like the Earth by 26.7 degrees, and just like the equinox on the Earth, the Sun can be right over the equator of the Earth, just like a couple days ago, the first day of spring. But it's now the first day of spring on Saturn, and so the Sun is directly over the equator, which is also the location of Saturn's rings. And so the sunlight is shining just edge on to the rings, and they're very thin, only about 10 meters, like 30 feet thick. And wow. So at the moment that they're edge on, they're invisible to us from the Earth just because we're looking at something so thin, like a sheet of paper. If you looked at it from the edge, you wouldn't be able to see it.
How have scientists and astronomers been able to measure the thickness of the rings of Saturn? And what are they made of?
So the rings of Saturn are made of mostly ice with small contaminants from meteoritic dust. And each particle in the rings, of which there are billions, are circling Saturn in an orbit that takes about 10 hours. So there's like a cloud of dust particles. And the way that we've measured the thickness of the rings are by watching waves that pass through the rings. The waves are dependent on damping in the rings, and we're able to measure the size by how quickly the waves pass away. Additionally, we've been able to measure the thickness of the rings by watching stars that set behind Saturn. From spacecraft, we watch the star set, and it very quickly disappears, which shows the rings must be very thin.
Amazing. So this ring plane crossing, as it's known, it only lasts a few days. Are there things about Saturn that can be better studied when the rings are absent?
So every time an astronomer looks at the rings at Saturn, the rings get in the way. And so when the rings disappear, it's possible to get a picture of Saturn without that contaminated blockage. And so we can watch during that period clouds near the equator on Saturn. And it's a particular period that was used by spacecraft like the Cassini spacecraft to observe Saturn in a period when there was no obstruction by the rings.
So when can we expect this phenomenon, this ring plane crossing, to happen again?
It happens every 15 years. And it's because of the orbit of Saturn being approximately 30 years long. The last time was in 2009 in August when the Cassini spacecraft was orbiting Saturn, and particular measurements were made of the ring and its disappearance at that time.
Finally, Larry, I just have to ask you about the 274 moons recently identified as satellites of Saturn. I mean, that is a huge jump in the planet's total moons. As hardened as Saturn is in the human imagination, we just seem to keep learning a lot about the planet.
Absolutely. And a big boost in our knowledge came from the European NASA Cassini mission, which ended in 2017. But we're still analyzing the data from that, and continuing Earth observations and observations from the Webb Space Telescope will continue to increase our understanding of Saturn and its rings. It's a great period ahead for us.
Larry Esposito is a professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder, speaking with us there from a busy Denver airport. You're listening to The World.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. I've spent the past 4 years investigating a crime.
When you're driving down this road, I might plan on killing somebody.
A four-year investigation, hundreds of interviews, thousands of documents, all in an effort to see what the U.S. military has kept from the public for years.
Did you think that a war crime had been committed?
I don't have any opinion on that.
Season 3 of In the Dark is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In a recent exchange between Elon Musk and the foreign minister of Poland, Musk seemed to threaten Ukraine to stop using his Starlink satellite communication system. The multibillionaire quickly issued a statement saying he would never do this. But there is enough uncertainty about American support for Ukraine that Europe is now looking for alternatives to Starlink. John Lawrenson filed this report from Paris for our partners DW, Deutsche Welle.
After Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, it immediately destroyed Ukraine's communications network. It was a huge blow, disrupting communication inside the Ukrainian army, but also because modern weapon systems, attack drones, for example, need the internet to find their targets. Elon Musk's response was quick and decisive. He rushed thousands of terminals to Ukraine so the country and its armed forces could use his Starlink satellite communication system. This aid was, as the entrepreneur himself said, crucial.
Starlink was the only one that was still operating. And even today, it is still the only one that is effective at the front lines. And Starlink today is the backbone of the Ukrainian military communications.
During his recent Tetchi exchange with the Polish foreign minister, during which Musk called the minister a small man, the multi-billionaire claimed there is no alternative to Starlink. But Europeans beg to differ. Eva Benecke is the director of the French satellite communications company Eutelsat.
Pour Ukraine, en fait, début de la crise en Ukraine.
From the start of the Ukrainian war, we were supplying satellite communications capacity to European companies who provided Ukraine with terminals. This conflict shows clearly how important satellite communications have become on the battlefield. It is clear that Starlink satellite communications, but also ours, although people talk about it less, is essential when it comes to troop movements, but also for the civilian population with the mobile telephone networks out of action.
The difference in capacity between Eutelsat and Starlink looks very big on paper. Elon Musk's company has 6,000 satellites in low orbit, Eutelsat 634. But, says Benecke, the French firm could replace Starlink in Ukraine.
Our satellites do the same job. We have the same global coverage with our 600 satellites. The big difference is that we orbit higher at 1,200 kilometers, while they're at 400 kilometers. So, very simply, you need a lot more satellites when you're orbiting closer to Earth. It's above all about having secure coverage that covers the whole territory, even when the electricity is down. That's important.
Eva Benecke says discussions are underway about taking a more important role in Ukraine.
Those discussions are taking place, above all, over the number of terminals in Ukraine. We have supplied hundreds, even thousands of terminals. In other words, antennas on the ground that people can use. Now, we are looking at how we could radically increase that number so that if Starlink unplugs, they'll have a backup.
The value of Eutelsat stock has increased by around 400% since the start of the month, with the prospect of increased European government defence spending and an increased role in Ukraine. John Lawrenson, Paris.
That story comes to us from our partners, DW, Deutsche Welle. In Chinese cuisine, some dishes have names that practically beg for a story. You've got forbidden rice, beggar's chicken, ants climbing a wall. That one's ground meat mixed with glass noodles. A new cookbook that reads like a comic book gets into those origin stories in Chinese folklore. Buddha Jumps Over the Wall and Other Curiously Named Classic Chinese Dishes is the title. The author, Ying Chang Kompestein, spoke recently with my co-host, Carolyn Beeler.
First, the title. I have never had this dish known as Buddha Jumps Over the Wall. What is it and what's the story behind it?
Well, the legend is there's a traveling scholar and one day stop outside the temple to cook lunch for himself. So he made a stew of meat, seafood, and various spices. And the aroma dripped over the monastery wall. One of the small hungry monk, he just can't help himself. Despite his vegetarian vow, he jumped over the wall and asked back the scholar to share the meal with him. So the joke is even a Buddha would jump over the wall to eat it. That means that would show, just show how delicious this dish is.
It's so good he ignores his vow of vegetarianism to get at some of that stew.
Yes. It basically, it's a stew. You can put whatever you like. There's a vegetarian version just with tofu, or you can put the meat or seafood. The key is the spices and the time you take to cook the meal, and so all the flavor can enrich together.
Mm. And what got you so interested in the names and the legends behind some of these Chinese dishes?
Well, I always love food and the children. And this is my 27th book. I wrote picture books for children and I wrote cookbooks for adults before. So when I was thinking about my next project, I just thought, well, I want to combine my two passions together. And then that reminds me, you know, often when I eat at a restaurant with friends, they always ask me, why is this, what's this name mean? I thought, wow, I should just write a book to combine my two passions, the picture book, illustration, and the food together to create this graphic novel cookbook for all ages.
So you write in this book that you learn the stories behind the names of these dishes from your grandmother. What are your strongest memories of helping her in the kitchen when you were growing up in Wuhan, China?
I have two elder brothers. So when I was young, I loved to follow my grandmother in the kitchen, not because I wanted help, because I want to get to the food before my brother did. So also, I love to hear her stories. So she often tell me story behind the dishes she make. And also, you know, just tell me the folktale stories that she remembered. And that was sort of a fun memory of my childhood. As if, you know, I grown up in Wuhan during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. During that time, food was rationed and the book was banned. So for me to follow her in the kitchen, not only I get to eat before my brother, I also kind of get hungry for food. I'm hungry for the stories that I would not be able to get otherwise because we were forced to read all the propaganda stories at the school.
So you include your family in this book, your upbringing in Wuhan, China. What kind of feelings did that surface for you as you revisited that time and place?
It was a very difficult time, very challenging time. At the time, I didn't know how hard it was until I look back. But I think that experience made me who I am today. I think the hardship really taught me to be strong, to be persistent.
That persistence has paid off. Ying Chang Kompestein's cookbook in comic form is Buddha Jumps Over the Wall and Other Curiously Named Classic Chinese Dishes. We have the recipe for Dun Dun Noodles and the story behind it at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Israeli military carried out strikes in the Gaza Strip and in Lebanon over the weekend. Palestinian officials in Gaza say the death toll since the war began has now surpassed 50,000 people. In Lebanon, Israeli airstrikes reportedly killed at least 8 people, jeopardizing a U.S.-brokered ceasefire with Hezbollah reached in November. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is also waging a big political battle within his own country. Last week, he announced the firing of the Shin Bet security head, Ronan Bar. Now he's pushing to remove Attorney General Gali Baharav Miara. To learn more about this, we reached out to former Israeli diplomat Alon Pincus. He served as Israel's consul general in New York, and he joined us from Tel Aviv.
This is probably the most critical week in the history of Israel's democracy. If everything works according to what Mr. Netanyahu hopes to achieve this week, and this is only Monday, then by next week, by the end of this week and early next week, Israel will be much more like Turkey or Hungary. Two critical guardrails, the head of the security services, the Shin Bet, and the attorney general will have been dismissed. The government is dealing with a complete overhaul of the judge selection committee. This is a government, mind you, that is boycotting the president of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice, because they don't recognize the legality of his election. The very foundations and very nature of Israeli democracy is being altered as we speak. If, I emphasize, if it works.
If the attempts that are being made to remove the attorney general work.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, in the past, Israel's Supreme Court and a vocal and protesting Israeli public have provided checks and balances on the country's executive. Do either the court and the public still have muscle to flex?
The Supreme Court answers, obviously, to petitions and appeals. But then there's the public, which is much more amorphous. Now, the Israeli public has proven very resilient, very energized throughout 2023 during that constitutional coup that I referred to. But this is a different setting. This is a different context. Since the war began, the public at large is dejected. It is confounded. It is devastated. It is still agonizing. And so it remains to be seen whether this will evolve into a huge, massive demonstration, which signs of which have started to appear, or if, conversely, if the public is subdued and resigned, you know, and these protests will come and go, but they will not be big and they will not be durable.
Well, how do these internal political dynamics have an impact on how Israel's waging war in Gaza? Is it dependent on the public and the anger?
It does. I mean, obviously, in terms of the military, don't forget that the Israeli military is not a professional military, as is the case in the U.S., but is basically a small standing army, which is augmented significantly by a reservist corps. These people are civilians. They have jobs, they have families, they have friends, they have political opinions, they have political affiliations. And if you look at consistent polls, over 65% disapprove of Mr. Netanyahu, over 70%, over 70% want him to resign. So that could come into play. But the real issue is, why is Mr. Netanyahu waging this war in Gaza? In Gaza, it seems as if the same rationale that led Mr. Netanyahu to extend the war unnecessarily, according to many, for 15 months or almost a year and a half, the same rationale led him to violate the ceasefire 6 days ago exactly and resume the war. There seems to be no attainable military objective, and there certainly isn't any kind of a political objective at the end, except for perpetual war, which is good for him politically.
Demonstrations and public opinion, though, have done very little to change Netanyahu's war plans.
Correct. That's because they have been few and far between. But the combination of the war in Gaza and what's going on with this constitutional coup, the firings of both the head of the Shin Bet and the attorney general, that could weld them together. That could create a fusion, public, political, that who knows what it would lead to.
Elon, what is Netanyahu's endgame? Like, who or what would he ultimately hand over power to? Or do you think in his mind he does not see the end of his road?
He has developed a Louis XIV sense of, I am the state. The state cannot survive without me. I am the embodiment of the state. There is no end game other than political survival. Now, yes, he's beleaguered. Yes, he's besieged. Yes, he's weakened. Yes, he's panicking. Yes, he's desperate. Call it what you want, but he's still in power. And so the end game for him would be to stay in power. He can't call for an election right now because he would most likely lose that election. You have to add a few other factors here. The fact that he's testifying today was the 19th day in which he's testifying in his own trial on charges of bribery, corruption, and obstruction of justice, or breach of trust, rather. And there are other factors that are contributing to a besieged prime minister, which makes him, by the way, according to his critics, far more dangerous rather than alleviate what he's doing.
Alon Pincus is a former Israeli diplomat. He joined us from Tel Aviv. Urban life can be loud. That's why Ulf Bohman seeks out one particular park in Stockholm, the Djurskogen Nature Reserve, just to bask in the stillness.
You walk out of the subway and up, and then it's this long stretch straight into a green area that's totally covered. So as you walk step by step, you kind of lower your stress levels. And in the middle of that park is a lake, a small lake that's totally surrounded by greenery and trees, so you don't see anything of the city. It might take you like 45 minutes to do the walk around the park, but you are like a new human being when you walk out.
Bohman makes a good case for the restorative power of being in the peace and quiet of nature. It's a focus of the nonprofit group he's part of, Quiet Parks International. We reached Bohman recently in the ski town of Åre, Sweden, to learn why finding quiet places is both important and hard to do.
I was into the public health sector for a very long time, and then I realized what would really affect the health and well-being of people. And I see it as contact with nature and the ability to listen is something we're really lacking in our everyday life.
You know, anybody who's ever been to a loud rock show knows what it's like afterwards. Your ears are ringing. But, you know, the capital of Dhaka, as I said, super bad noise pollution, and it's always there. So I'm wondering, how serious are the health risks?
Oh, you say today that noise pollution is the second biggest risk after air pollution for our health. The short-term risk is stress-related, and the long-term risk is everything from heart-related problems to mental health issues.
And the corollary, are there health benefits of finding quiet places to spend time in?
Yes, there's more and more studies on that too, that access to green space that's quiet and just a nice area, a nice environment, lowers your blood pressure.
The quiet park in Stockholm, I mean, it's not the only one in the world, right? Where else have these quiet parks been established so far?
We have them quite spread out over the world. We have them in Spain and in Belgium and a few also in the U.S.
I see you also have quiet parks in Taipei, the Taiwanese capital, and London.
Yeah, and these urban parks, some are small parks and some are more bigger nature reserves. So in Taipei, we have quite a large nature reserve that's very close to the city, that's easy accessible. It's still an urban park, but it's quite a big one. In London, it's not small, but it's a normal city park.
What does it take exactly to create a quiet park, and what does it mean in practical terms?
We have to do an evaluation of the park, and it's never the entire park that's quiet. We try to find areas within the park that are more quiet, and we have a set level of noise. We use a decibel level of 45. That's the basic level, but then also it can't be too much disturbance from planes overhead. We can accept a few. We have to accept a few disturbances in urban parks, but not too many. And then the total experience of the park has to be both safe and quiet. Quiet in the sense to seeing greenery, have a lot of greenery and not too much of the city infrastructure in your viewpoint.
One mission of your organization, Quiet Parks International, is called Quiet Preservation. And last year, you named a nature reserve in Namibia as Africa's first wilderness quiet park. Can you tell us more about that initiative?
We also work with wilderness areas all over the world. And of course, the standards for what is quiet in a wilderness area is tougher. And we have one basis is that in a wilderness area, you should be able to sit at least for 15 minutes without any human-made sound. Mm. So it's a different standard, but it's the same idea that these places need to be protected. In the U.S., it's even when it comes to wilderness parks, it's quite hard to find the one that has 15 minutes of quiet because air traffic is everywhere. It's crisscrossed over the U.S. and it goes straight over the national parks and the big parks too.
I mean, the point I hear you're making is that quiet spaces are really hard to find these days.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you might be surprised to find them in different places. We should kind of use the challenge to start listening to your own surrounding, because sometimes you can find it, maybe not in a park if you don't have a park, but maybe behind a church or in that quiet and safe street around the corner.
Ulf, I can't help but notice that your voice is also kind of quiet. Like, I need to lean in and hear you. And I'm wondering, is that a coincidence or this is just who you are?
I think it's just who I am. Maybe you get a bit quiet when this is what you work with, where listening is such a part. You might whisper to the world a bit, maybe.
That's Ulf Bowman with Quiet Parks International speaking with us from Åre, Sweden. Costa Rica is famous for its coffee, but this year the country has been producing a lot less of it. That's because Costa Rica's coffee industry depends on migrant workers, and many of them have not been able to make the trip lately. Reporter Manuel Reda went to Costa Rica's coffee-growing region for a first-hand look at what's going on.
It's harvesting time at Finca Manassas, a family-owned coffee farm in the center of Costa Rica. Mayra Urbina, a farm worker from Nicaragua, treads among the green coffee bushes with a bucket attached to her waist. She wears a floppy hat to shield her face from the sun and uses gloves as she scrapes red berries from the branches of the coffee plants.
Les gusta venir aquí a recolectar café porque rinde más la plata aquí que allá.
I like coming to Costa Rica, Urbina says. Here, we can make twice as much money as in Nicaragua. Costa Rica has the highest wages in Central America, and for decades it has depended largely on Nicaraguan farm workers to harvest its coffee plantations. Fernando Naranjo is the owner of Finca Manassas. He says it's become very hard to find locals who want to pick coffee.
Costa Rica ha invertido mucho en salud y en educación.
Costa Rica has invested a lot of money in health and education, he says. So that gives young people here the option to work in other jobs that can pay more and are less physically demanding. Coffee farmers like Mr. Naranjo have become accustomed to relying on migrant workers who usually stay at their farms for 2 or 3 months. But this year, farms have struggled with labor shortages, as Nicaragua makes it harder for its own citizens to migrate. In November, the Nicaraguan government passed an immigration law that allows border officials to deny Nicaraguans entry into their own country. The new law is trying to stop political dissidents from returning to Nicaragua, but it's been applied to some people who have no involvement in politics, says Yader Valdivia, a Nicaraguan human rights lawyer.
Si salimos, corremos el riesgo de no ingresar al país.
If you leave Nicaragua, you now run a real risk of not being let back in, he says. People have been denied entry or fined without a clear explanation. As a result, migrant farm workers have been staying at home this year, and that's had an impact on Costa Rica's coffee harvest. Carlos Fonseca is a consultant who works with more than 20 Costa Rican farms. He says his clients lost about 10% of their crop this year.
Fincas que ocupaban 100 recolectores.
We had farms that needed 100 people, but were only able to recruit 40 workers, he says. The coffee cherries were drying up on the plants because there was no one to collect them. In response, Costa Rica's National Coffee Association launched a campaign to recruit local workers. It published ads on newspapers as well as social media videos, encouraging people to work in the coffee fields. In one video, former Olympic athlete Gabriela Traña, now in her 40s and a celebrity in Costa Rica, can be seen working on a coffee farm. When I was in school, I used to pick coffee during the holidays, she says. And I loved it because it taught us how important it is to work hard and have goals in life. Farmers say they have gotten some calls from local workers thanks to the campaign. But they also say those workers don't stay for long. And sometimes they ask for conditions that farmers cannot afford.
Y me dijeron, queremos ir a ver las casas y el garaje para el carro.
I had people who called and asked if I had a house for them to stay in and a garage for their car, says farm owner Fernando Naranjo. I don't even have a garage for my own car, he says. Arias, the coffee consultant, says Costa Rican workers won't really fill the void, so in the long run, farms in the country will have to depend less on manual labor. One possible solution is to use handheld machines that shake the coffee berries off the plants. Farms could also leave more space in between coffee bushes to let small tractors pass by when collecting berries. But that might not be possible, given the steep terrain of most Costa Rican coffee farms. We're still in the trial and error phase when it comes to using machines, Arias says. In the meantime, farmers still depend on migrant workers. Arias says that farms in Costa Rica are trying to offer coffee pickers higher wages and even daycare centers for their children to encourage them to join next year's harvest. But immigration laws could still discourage Nicaraguan farmers from making the trip to Costa Rica. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Costa Rica.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. During the Cold War, Oleg Gordievsky was a top intelligence officer for the former Soviet Union. He was posted at their embassy in London, but that was just one of his jobs. Another was spying for the British intelligence agency, MI6, a job that nearly got him killed. Gordievsky is widely regarded to have been a crucial double agent for the West. He died at his home in the UK earlier this month at the age of 86. Writer Ben McIntyre interviewed Gordievsky extensively for his book, The Spy and the Traitor.
Oleg Gordievsky was able to open up the KGB to Western intelligence in a way that no other spy had ever done before. He was a very senior officer, and he was able to tell MI6 and the CIA, latterly, not only what the KGB was doing, but what it was planning to do. And that was a huge advantage. That is gold dust in intelligence. It is argued, rightly, I think, that Oleg Gordievsky played a crucial part in averting a really serious nuclear confrontation. Now, this was in 1983, and Gordievsky was able to point out to the West that the Kremlin was genuinely paranoid about the danger of a first strike. They believed the West was going to attack first. KGB officers around the world have been sent out to find evidence. Now, of course, if you go looking for evidence, you tend to find it, particularly in a sort of hierarchical structure like the KGB. What Gordievsky was able to do was to alert the West that this was happening, and they stepped back from the brink. By this point, nuclear warheads had already been primed behind the Iron Curtain for what they believed was going to be a first strike. They were going to attack first.
Wow. I mean, head of the KGB in London, I mean, not some lower vulnerable officer who might be tapped. So how was he recruited to spy against Russia? I mean, how do you even start to flip anyone like that, given the risks they would be running with the Kremlin?
Well, absolutely. I mean, he's a particularly interesting case, Gordievsky, because, of course, he was born into the KGB. His father had been a KGB officer. He'd been brought up in a special kind of KGB compound. Spying was in his blood. And yet, he's one of the very few spies who was a pure ideological spy. I mean, there are many motivations for becoming a double agent. But in his case, it was absolute conviction that the regime he was serving was brutal, barbaric, illiberal, and wrong. And the moment he really realized that, the key moment came in 1968, actually, quite a long time before he was recruited by Western intelligence, when he witnessed the sort of crushing of the Prague Spring, when the Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia to snuff out the sort of fledgling liberalization movement there. And he was absolutely astounded and horrified by that. But it wasn't until 6 years later in Copenhagen that he was actually approached by British intelligence and over a long, long courtship was eventually persuaded to spy for the UK. And he did so for 11 years under incredibly dangerous circumstances. If he'd been caught, if he'd made a slip, he would have been arrested, he would have been interrogated, he would have been tortured, and he would have been killed.
Well, Ben, maybe you can talk about the moment that Gordievsky realized his cover was blown.
The CIA was getting intelligence from MI6. And without telling MI6, it began to try and investigate who this spy was, because it's a convention in spycraft that while you will pass information to allies, you don't have to identify your sources. And MI6 didn't. And so the CIA began investigating itself, and it worked it out. The person in charge of that investigation was himself a KGB spy. That was Aldrich Ames. Aldrich Ames was quite a senior CIA officer, deeply disgruntled. He decided to spy for the KGB for money.
Mm.
Oleg Gordievsky was summoned back to Moscow. He was told that he was coming back to be anointed as head of the KGB in London. And he went back to his Moscow apartment. He got to the airport. He went to his own apartment, which he hadn't been in for some years. And he unlocked the door, and he unlocked the top lock, and he unlocked the second lock. But he couldn't unlock the third lock. But he'd never used the third lock.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good.
And from that second, he realized that the KGB must have been in his apartment.
How did he escape prison ultimately, or even execution in Russia?
The escape signal, what he had to do was to be standing on a particular corner in Moscow holding a red Safeway bag from the old supermarket, a bright red Safeway bag. That was the signal that he needed to activate his escape. The acceptance signal that MI6 had seen it would be that one of their officers, he didn't know what they looked like, but one of them would walk past him eating a Mars bar or a Kit Kat.
Wow. One of those two.
One of those two. Believe it or not. From that moment, he then had to get up to a specific site on the border with Finland at the same time as two MI6 officers driving diplomatic cars would drive up to the lay-by. He would then be bundled into the boot and smuggled across the border. When they got him across the border and he's crouched in the boot of the car, they put on Sibelius's Finlandia as loud as they could on the cassette in the front of the car. That was a signal that he was in Finland and that he was free.
That is epic. Double agent, clearly it's not something anyone can do. After you spoke with Gordievsky at length, I mean, did you come to any conclusion about what made him such an exceptional person? What made him tick?
He believed in himself utterly. That didn't always make him easy company. You know, he could be very difficult. He was a complicated and irascible man in some ways, but he never wavered from the belief that what he'd done was the right thing to do and that he'd played a vital part in history, that he'd changed the course of history. And in all those years that I knew him, I never heard him express a single word of regret for what he'd done, even though in many ways it had destroyed his life. I mean, it had ruined his marriage. He became estranged from his children. An easy life that he could have had as a KGB officer evaporated. And he spent 40 years as a prisoner of history in some ways. I mean, living in a safe house in suburban London, it was a comfortable life in some ways, but he knew he was under permanent threat. There was a death sentence waiting for him, indeed out on him. And you know, they wanted to have a private funeral. And that was a security concern. I mean, they didn't, they didn't want to have a public funeral where former intelligence people would have been gathered. So they kept it secret and didn't announce it until this week. Which I think was probably very sensible, but in a way rather fitting. You know, he came to this country in secrecy. He spent his life in secrecy and he died in secrecy. He was both the kind of loneliest person I've ever met and the bravest.
Ben McIntyre is author of the book, The Spy and the Traitor, about the double agent Oleg Gordievsky. Gordievsky died earlier this month. He was 86. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Glasscock Heritage Trust, Jennifer Woodruff, Cindy Engels, Merle Kurtzrock and George Zimmerman, and Carrie and Nelson Hoffman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.